Behavioral economics has taught us that many of our decisions are irrational and contrary to our own interests. So what now? That is, how do we use that self-knowledge to make better choices at work and at home? In the new book, The Power of 50 Bits, The New Science of Turning Good Intentions into Positive Results, Bob Neese shares his concepts for activating our latent good intentions to produce positive results in our professional and personal lives. Neese named his approach after a jaw-dropping statistic. Of the 10 million bits of information that our brains process each second, only 50 bits are devoted to conscious thought. Put simply, we are wired for inattention and inertia, and we haven't evolved to keep pace with our environment. This cognitive limitation leads to a disconnect between what people want and what they actually do. Bob Neese is a former chief scientist at Express Scripts, where he spearheaded efforts that applied behavioral science to optimize the healthcare experience for patients. His new book is The Power of 50 Bits, The New Science of Turning Good Intentions into Positive Results. The book is published by Harper, and we welcome Bob Neese to the roundtable this morning. Bob, thank you very much for being a part of the program.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to this particular idea?
Well, you know, I'm trained in more rational decision making. I have a degree in something called engineering economic systems, which simply put is sort of a practical application of classical economics. And the idea there is that people are rational and they should behave in their own self-interest. But I found out pretty quickly in real life when I was working at a large healthcare company that that wasn't the case at all. It's not like people run the numbers and make the right decision. So I became really interested in what were the forces driving what people actually do. And I was wondering whether we could reshape the environment in which people find themselves so that their natural inclinations would lead to better behaviors.
So let's start with a baseline. When you talk about 50 bits, you are talking about 50 bits of information, basically of what we can comprehend in a second. Is that it?
Yeah. So the book is a practical field guide for people to improve behaviors at work or at home, customers, coworkers, loved ones themselves. And it's based on this really fascinating insight about how the brain works. So your brain, my brain, they each process about 10 million bits of information a second, which is a huge amount of information. It's the throughput of the original Ethernet cable. But the conscious part of our brains, our minds, the part that makes deliberate decisions, that only runs at about 50 bits per second. So whether we like it or not, our brains are wired for inattention and inertia, and it turns out that that's really what's at the heart of many of our bad behaviors. And the book lays out 7 strategies to overcome that limitation, improve behaviors, and deliver better results.
So a lot of our behaviors are unintentional then. So even if we make pretty good choices, that actually goes against the odds, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it turns out, if you think about it, 50 bits is a teeny tiny, you know, fraction of what the brain does. And so it's a scarce resource, and we point our 50 bits at things that are either really, really pressing or really pleasurable. And that means there are a lot of important things that we just can't attend to, and those things tend to slide, and over time, there's a gap that's created between the good intentions, you know, what we would do if we stopped and really thought about it, and what we actually do in our day-to-day behavior. And this insight's critical because the solution then isn't to try to change people's intentions, but rather to find strategies that activate the good intentions that most people already have.
So do good intentions and bad intentions, are they equal when it comes to the brain, or do they have greater power?
Well, if you think about it, I've met a lot more people with good intentions than bad intentions. And so most bad behaviors that we run across, even though this is counterintuitive, I guess because it's counterintuitive, it's so critical, most of the bad behaviors we run across are not bad intentions upon which people are acting, despite what you read in the news. I mean, if you look at just everyday behavior, most bad behaviors are good intentions that lay dormant. And that's a critical insight if you're going to develop solutions that lead to practical results.
So when we say bad intentions, I mean, it's a wide range, right? I mean, we're talking about everything about from having a chocolate milkshake for breakfast to mass murder.
Yeah. Yeah, the book's not written for the mass murderers.
Okay.
I'll admit that. I try not to hang out with those people too much.
All right, we're worried more about the milkshakes.
Yeah, okay. I think so. And, you know, we're just, it's the middle of January, and some of us, not to name any names, but some of us have made New Year's resolutions, and already they're starting to become unraveled. And the reason that happens is that, you know, when we're making intentions, we're focusing our 50 bits on this problem. We say, you know, gosh darn it, this is going to be the year that I exercise. And, you know, by week two and certainly by month six, a lot of those good intentions get laid aside. So the book is really about how to make sure those intentions see the light of day.
So give us the nugget as to the seven things that we need to do to make those stick.
Yeah, so go back to the main problem. The main problem is that our brains essentially are wired for inattention and inertia, and the seven strategies in the book fall into one of those two buckets. So one set of strategies is about demanding the 50 bits that we have and making sure that we make those decisions and implement them. The other set of strategies, which is really fascinating, is really psychological jujitsu, and that is to leverage inertia. In other words, if you can put yourself or your coworkers or your loved ones or your clients on the right track, then all of a sudden inertia is your ally rather than your enemy. In other words, somebody has to actively do something to get off that right track. And both sets of strategies can work really, really well in a multitude of settings.
As of calendar year 2016, you are the first person on the program to use the term psychological jiu-jitsu. So let us, with that said, once we, even if we do it more consciously, is it then always a conscious, quick decision, or do we have to keep retraining ourselves and can we get out of the habit quickly?
Yeah, I think the best approach is, and the most realistic approach, is to stop trying to change minds. Stop trying to change our minds and our loved ones' minds, our coworkers' minds, our customers' minds. The best way to see behavior change is to re-engineer the environment in which we find ourselves to advantage better behavior, because frankly, that's the way our brains were built. They were built for a time and a place that was long ago and far away. And that environment has changed radically, and our brains have just not kept up. So it's really easier to re-engineer and reshape the environment to advantage better behaviors and to discourage less desirable behaviors. And if you do that, even small changes over time pile on each other, and you can see, you know, magnificent results over time.
So how important is it for us to know ourselves, have self-knowledge to make better choices?
Yeah, here's the critical thing. I mean, if there's only one point you take away from the book, it's that most of our behaviors are automatic and happen under the radar. As counterintuitive as that seems, almost everything that we do is a result of either a built habit or an instinct that's, you know, that we're born with. And when you believe that, I mean, when you really, really believe that, you start looking for ways to place cues in your environment, to create obstacles to bad behaviors, to streamline things for good behaviors, and you see far better results than trying to, frankly, just change your mind. That's the most important piece of self-knowledge.
So you talk about in the book this idea of re-engineering the world around them so that their natural inclinations lead to better behaviors, i.e. not drink the milkshake for breakfast.
Yep.
But that idea of re-engineering the world seems more difficult than just not buying ice cream.
It's a little easier than you think, but you have to take it, you know, you have to take it seriously, and so it may seem awkward at first. So let me give you a couple examples. If the problem is eating at home, then put the salad and the fruit and the lean meat on the table, and put the wine and the potatoes and the bread on the counter. And that simply creating a slight hesitation will mean that you will have to actively choose to eat those, you know, carbohydrate, if that's what you're trying to avoid, heavy foods. Does it make a huge difference? No. But America's weight problem is a problem of 150 to 200 calories a day. If everybody cut out 150, 200 calories, over time we would lose all the extra weight that we have. So these little changes make a big difference. If it's the workplace and you think your workers are sedentary, you could do something like take the chairs out of all the meeting rooms. It's interesting, right? We want our workers to be more active, but we've built these conference rooms to essentially say the default is to sit. So one of the strategies is to change the default so that standing is the expected behavior. If you want to go get a chair, you can go get one. And I'll bet you that there would be a lot of people standing that would otherwise be sitting. That's what I mean by reengineering the environment.
So when we talk about the powers of persuasion or influence, if we're doing so much under the radar in our decision making, how then do things like persuasion and influence get us to, if you will, tap those 50 bits on the shoulder and say, pay attention to us?
Yeah, you know, I think the challenge with a word like persuasion, at least what comes to mind for me, is that you're trying to change the underlying intention. So there's an assumption built into that strategy that I think, doesn't necessarily fit the evidence. If most of what we do is good intentions that don't get acted on, spending time trying to change those underlying intentions is really not going to get the job done. I mean, it's better to activate the good intentions that most people have. So that's what I think of when I think about influence and persuasion. Other people might think of different things. I think of something a little more, you know, sort of going after intentions, which is usually not the problem.
You make the point that Apple products, for example, are successful because they don't have a manual. They run from intuition. They run by people working intuitively. That's a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a good thing. The overarching idea in the book is to simplify wisely. And what that means is if you can get people to head the right direction, then you want to remove all obstacles and let them proceed as quickly and seamlessly as possible. If they're heading the wrong direction, you want to actually slow them down and get them to think about it all the way to the point of stopping them and saying, do you want to do this or do you want to do that? I think Apple products, and I think a lot of successful products, are those which just work intuitively. And our brains like that because it's just easier. And it happens quickly, and it doesn't require any additional cognitive resources. I think, you know, if you looked at some of the maybe Apple products that are maybe having a more difficult time, you might find that, in fact, they're not that intuitive. They're a little difficult to figure out and configure. So I the last time I looked at the Apple Watch, there were some people who were saying, you know, once I got it figured out, it was great, but up front it was, a little bit difficult. That's a recipe for trouble.
So what does it say about us if we feel, or me, if we feel that we need a manual? Is that on me or is that on Apple?
No, I wouldn't say that about you, Joe. No.
But I mean, if it isn't intuitive, is it then the fault of them not making it more intuitive, or is it your fault for being a dummy for not being able to figure out because it is intuitive and you just haven't figured it out?
No, it's definitely their fault.
Okay,
let's blame
the big powerful company.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. I'm at an age now where I feel like if I can't get it, otherwise I'd be blaming myself all the time. I can't get anything anymore.
I understand the point of the book, and I find it fascinating. It does seem, though, that a lot of what's going on in our mind then is sort of being wasted.
Really? Is that what you think? That certainly wasn't.
What's happening with
10 million bits?
Yeah, I mean, if you have 10 million bits of information being consumed by your brain each second. And when it comes to us, we're only processing 50. It seems like we're...
What's happening with the rest of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just think. Do you remember when you learned how to drive a car? I don't know if you were a teenager or...
Yeah.
I'm assuming you know how to drive a car.
25 or so, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, when you learn how to drive a car, You're using every last one of your 50 bits to do that. You're figuring out how to adjust the mirrors, how hard to turn the steering wheel left or right, where you put your foot, do you press this hard or that hard. It takes everything you've got, and that is why new drivers have more accidents. You would think it's because teenagers are risk-seeking, and that does pop up later. But when they're first learning to drive a car, this happens because we're using the deliberate part of our brain to get the job done. But one of the remarkable things about humans, we call it muscle memory, but if you repeat something over and over again, that task actually gets handed to those 10 million bits or part of the 10 million bits. So now when you drive your car, you don't think about any of those things. None of your 50 bits is deployed trying to figure out how hard to press on the gas or how hard to turn the steering wheel. That all happens automatically. So I think it's magnificent. I mean, I think it's fantastic that we can walk without thinking, that, you know, we can reach and grab a door, that we can catch a baseball. All these things happen automatically and under the radar. And we should be thankful for that, because it's a much more efficient way to get things done than if we were trying to calculate things with our, you know, rational, slow-moving 50 bits.
Well, the name of the book is The Power of 50 Bits, The New Science of Turning Good Intentions into Positive Results. It is published by Harper Business. Bob Neese, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. Delight to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Power of 50 Bits. It's published by Harper Business by Bob Neese. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.